International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Wachovia Securities, 1605 South State Street in Champaign. Wachovia starts with your life and plans your money around it. More information is available from Tom Manolakis, First Vice President Investments, at 351-8694.
It's 6 minutes after 1 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Celeste Quinn is away. I'm Tom Rogers. Today we bring you something from the Afternoon Magazine Archives, a show that we first presented back in December of last year, with Celeste Quinn talking with the author of Choices Under Fire, historian Michael Bess. This is a pre-recorded program. No phone calls today, please.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Second World War has been called the Good War, a war won by America's greatest generation. On the program today, an acknowledgement of the justness of the war and the sacrifices made to win it. But we're also going to try to go beyond that and talk about the moral ambiguities and controversies of the war. Our guest this afternoon is historian Michael Bess. He is the author of Choices Under Fire, Moral Dimensions of World War II. Michael Bess sets out to do a couple of things in this book. First, to look into events that have been most controversial, most problematic. For example, the failure of the U.S. to offer aid to Europe's Jews in the 1930s, the internment of Japanese Americans, the bombing of civilian populations, including the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the alliance with Stalin. Second, he explores, as he says in the book's introduction, the underlying thematic linkages among seemingly far-removed events and decisions in order to shed new light on the forces that shape this epical conflict and its legacy. Michael Bess is Chancellor's Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. In addition to Choices Under Fire, Professor Bess is the author of The Light Green Society, Ecology and Technical Modernity in France, 1960 to 2000. His new book, Choices Under Fire, is published by Knopf. Michael Bess, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure.
You note that we need to do two things when we begin this kind of an examination. To do justice to the sacrifices made, the victory was won, that was won, and to do justice to the moral controversies of the war. And at the outset, you quote from Studs Terkel's book, The Good War, in Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, two books I alluded to in my introduction.
Yeah.
The passage you take from Terkel at the outset is very interesting. It offers us a glimpse of the ambiguities felt by an adolescent girl during the war. Would you care to summarize it for us?
Well, I was particularly taken with that passage when I read the book. It's a woman named Nancy Arnott Harjohn, and she was, I think, if I recall correctly, about 13 or 14 during the when the war started, and she was from San Francisco, from a fairly well-to-do family. And what she presents to Terkel is this, it's a fairly rambling assemblage of memories about the war, just as they happen to come up in her memory, and he very faithfully takes them down, not trying to put any artificial order on it. But what you really see is a combination of two strikingly different things. You see a tremendous pride in America's role in this war, in, you know, the outcome, the triumph over fascism, and you see very much her sense of involvement and identification with that pride and with that sense of this was one of the finest hours in our country's history. What you also see, though, is her doubts and questions, partially unanswered, partially she tries to answer them, about other aspects of the war. And one of the striking features that she remembers is that they had a Japanese-American young woman living with her family who was helping out with the housework and the kids, sort of a live-in nanny. And her name, if I remember correctly, was May. And this Japanese-American woman is, of course, early in 1942, ordered to leave the employ of this family and go into an internment camp. And it's the speaker, Nancy Harjun, gives this really wrenching account of her as a 13-year-old having to watch this Japanese-American woman who had always been wonderful, sort of a member of the family in a sense, being wrenched out of the family and sent off by the government into internment because suddenly she was considered a security threat. And you see she her really asking questions about why would she have been considered a security threat simply because she was of Japanese extraction. She had never given any sign of being anything but an American. She spoke with an American accent. She was an American citizen by birth, and yet she's being forced into these camps. And that's just one example. Then there was another example at the time of the atomic bombings, because Nancy Harjun recalls the elation felt by the country that the war was going to end. The atomic bombings had ended the war very, very swiftly. And then you see her sort of starting to say, but then we started hearing reports about the numbers of civilians killed on the ground and how many of those people were children and women and elderly people, handicapped people, people who had absolutely nothing to do with the war. And we started saying, was it really necessary? And was a second bomb on Nagasaki really necessary? And you see her starting to have doubts. And it's that mixture in her testimonial of the pride and the certainties that this was a just war, coupled with questions about specific policies and actions that were carried out by this country in the war, in fighting the just war, where she begins to say, well, you know, did everything, the fact that we were fighting a just war does not necessarily mean that everything we did was the right choice.
Yeah. Also, I was struck by her involvement, even as a teenage girl,
yes.
You know, as a very young girl, she's very involved. She's thinking about these things, and she also tried to enlist.
Yes.
So
she tried to give blood.
Yeah. So that's another important aspect. I mean, all of this little vignette,
yes,
essentially sets us on course for the rest of your book.
Yeah, it really does. And I find that I have my students here at Vanderbilt go and do an oral history. Interview somebody who lived through the war. Every year I have them do that. I don't know how many more years I'm going to be able to continue to do that. But they go out, and the sort of universal testimonial is precisely how people were drawn into this war. There was this feeling of unity, of being united in a terribly important and just cause. And so it gave people a sense of purpose that is often, you know, lacking in modern lives, and that's why Studs Terkel was struck by the nostalgia that people felt when they talked about their war, especially I guess civilians. Maybe the soldiers didn't feel so much nostalgia, especially the ones who really saw hand-to-hand combat. But everyone who participated really was drawn in to this war.
Where are we today, do you think, in dealing honestly with the moral questions that the Second World War presents us with?
Well, I think different countries have done dealt in different ways with coming to grips with the war. I think the Germans can be put at one end of the spectrum of dealing successfully with the war. I think the Germans have really... the majority of Germans have really come to terms with their responsibility for the crimes of Nazism and the crimes of their countrymen, whether they were Nazis or not. And I think they've done everything from donate huge amounts of money to try to make reparation to the people who were harmed by the war, who lost family members, and more importantly, perhaps, than just the money, they've really, as a people, there's historians, dozens of historians have gone very deeply into analyzing what happened, why it happened. They've not shied away from acknowledging what they did. The Japanese, I would say, have had much less success in confronting their responsibility for what was done by their country during the war. And I would put them at the other end of the spectrum. I'd say of all countries, the Japanese are the ones who still have the farthest to go before we could say they've really made a full reckoning with their responsibility for the crimes committed by the Japanese during the war. There's still a lot of denial, still a lot of people saying this was actually just a war against European imperialism, or denying outright that the atrocities that were committed by the Japanese against POWs, the rape of Manila, the rape of Nanking, this is still a very sore point between the Chinese and the Japanese. And this is all very well documented in a wonderful book by John Dower. There's two books by the historian John Dower, one on the Japanese war itself and one on the aftermath. And the one on the aftermath is called Embracing Defeat. And it really it gives a very powerful account of the areas that the Japanese still have to come to grips with. And I'd say the United States is closer to the German side than the Japanese side, but that there are still aspects of the war that the general population has not fully come to grips with. And I think the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is one aspect of the war that our nation has not fully come to terms with. And I think the strategic bombing campaign, using conventional weapons, incendiaries, and high explosives, the strategic bombing campaign is something we haven't fully come to grips with as a nation. Those are two examples of areas where I think we need a more in-depth reckoning.
Mm. Why have we been slow to look back and re-examine that or re-examine that, those aspects?
I think psychologically, it's hard for people. It takes a fairly sophisticated psychological constitution to be able to say, I did some really horrible things that could never be repaired, but that I thought at the time that they were the right thing, or I didn't even think about it one way or the other. I just went ahead and did it. If for an individual, acknowledging one's failings, acknowledging one's, the wrong things that one did, is far from easy. And I would say that the psychology of the moral dimensions of the war are very similar for a nation as a whole. So you find, some groups in the society eagerly and openly acknowledging what was done, and they have sort of a psychological makeup that allows them to say, look, I can still be a good person overall. We can still be think of ourselves as a good country, as a country that's by and large doing good things in the world, and still acknowledge that at times we made mistakes, serious mistakes that needlessly harmed large numbers of people. Other people are just incapable of that kind of nuanced or complex vision of themselves or of their country. They have to be either heroes or villains, good guys or bad guys. And if you're stuck in that fairly rigid and, I would say, psychologically not very developed attitude, you end up trying to whitewash the past and trying to deny or explain away those moments where, in my opinion, we could have done better.
Why is it important to look at the troubling aspects of the war?
Well, I think if you're going to, this applies once again to individuals, just as it does to entire national collectivities. If you're going to learn from your mistakes, first thing you have to do is acknowledge that it was a mistake. Otherwise, you're just going to keep repeating it in different ways. Sometimes people say history repeats itself, and as a historian, I always kind of smirk when I hear that because I don't believe history ever repeats itself. It's too complicated. The particular context is always different. And of course, there's free will. People have choice in different circumstances. So history does not mechanically repeat itself. But it is true that certain kinds of errors do. Those categories of errors or types of errors do get repeated. And one of those types of errors is based on sort of oversimplifying our understanding of what happened in the past. If we're going to try to not repeat the mistakes that we made, then we need to go back and find out what were the mistakes and how they happened and make sure that they don't happen again. Apply the lessons to the present context. I believe very much that that is possible to do. History may not repeat itself, but there are types of errors that do, and we can learn not to repeat them.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is historian Michael Bess. He is the author of Choices Under Fire, Moral Dimensions of World War II. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. We've got a couple of listeners who would like to talk with you, okay. Professor Bess, and so we're going to go first to a listener in Bloomington, Indiana, on line four. Hi.
Hi. About the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those bombings caused the Japanese to surrender, and they were an alternative to invading the main Japanese island. I'm sure you must know the estimates of the death toll in American troops that would have occurred by invading the main Japanese island. And not only in American troops, but of course in Japanese also.
Yes.
If you had been Harry Truman,
yes.
And you, sir,
yes.
had the choice of sacrificing all those American lives and the Japanese lives in opposing the Americans, the combat that would have occurred on that Japanese island.
Yes.
Are you going to tell me that you wouldn't have dropped that bomb?
Well, knowing what I know now, I think I would have. I'd say that the chapter on the decision to drop the atomic bomb is the longest chapter in the book because it's one of the most controversial topics. And it's one in which my own position has evolved over the years. When I left graduate school, I was convinced that the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a terrible evil, an absolute evil, something that should never have been done, and a stain on our country's history. And over the years, partially by arguing with my students and partially by hearing arguments, you know, persuasively put, like the one that you have just mentioned and just articulated, my position has come around because I asked the question that you basically have asked, which is, what would have been the alternative if we had not dropped the bomb? And that turns out to be enormously complicated. Answering that question, first of all, it takes us into speculation. It takes us into speculative history. And we have to then start playing out different scenarios. Scenario A, scenario B, scenario C. And that's why my chapter ends up being very, very long. But what I ended up concluding was that the dropping of the bomb, according to historians nowadays, the estimates, they've come down from the estimates right in the 1940s, in the late 1940s. The estimates are that about 50,000 American lives were saved.
Yes.
And that on the Japanese side, as far as I can tell, my own tally is that somewhere between 500,000 and 2,000,000 Japanese lives were saved, at least. That's a
uh-huh.
conservative estimate.
Mm-hmm.
And the atomic bombings cost about 340,000 lives, approximately. Those are estimates. And so I reach what I might describe as an agonizingly ambivalent conclusion about the dropping of the atomic bombs. I'm very uncomfortable with this conclusion, but I can't find any other conclusion to reach. And the conclusion is that by any standard of our civilization, of our morality, it was an atrocity. It's
yeah.
an atrocity to incinerate 100,000 non-combatant civilians, children, women, handicapped people. By any standard that we've ever applied, this is a clear-cut atrocity. And yet this was an atrocity that resulted in a net saving of somewhere around 500,000 to 2 million lives.
Well, now, isn't that the dilemma of warfare? When you have to go to war,
yes,
to defend your country, you know you're going to kill tens of thousands of people.
Yes.
It brings to mind something Golda Meir of Israel said. She said, we can forgive the Arabs, the Palestinians, for killing us.
Yeah.
But we have a harder time forgiving them for making us kill them.
Yes, that is the dilemma of warfare. And in the case of the atomic bombing, that's the ambiguous, ambivalent conclusion that I reach. In the case of the firebombing and carpet bombing of Japanese and German cities in 1944 and 1945, there my conclusion is actually much more trenchant and straightforward. I argue that that was an atrocity, and that's the worst atrocity that the Anglo-American forces committed during the war, that those were avoidable, that we could have won the war with a much more precise, measured strategic bombing campaign. I'm not saying that there shouldn't have been a strategic bombing campaign. What I'm saying is by 1944 and definitely by 1945, we had acquired the technological capability to conduct bombing in a much more restrained, measured, precise way. We could have focused on exclusively military assets and really minimized civilian casualties, non-combatant, the so-called collateral damage, which was the term invented at the time. And instead, what you see is 1944 and 1945, this is the climax of terror bombing, of indiscriminate butchery, tens of thousands of people killed by indiscriminate dropping of bombs, torching entire cities. This is what happens to an unprecedented level in 44 and 45. Right when we could have conducted, chosen a policy of really limiting, trying to limit the damage on the ground. And I think there's no justification for that.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. Recently on C-SPAN, Gore Vidal mentioned that there was correspondence, at least emanating from the Japanese side, exploring the possibility of surrender.
Yes.
And that the dropping of the bomb by President Truman wasn't aimed so much at the Japanese as at the Russians.
Yes.
And at the upcoming Cold War.
Right.
Excuse me. And that it really was unnecessary, ultimately. Right. Would you comment on that?
Sure.
I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
That's one of... I framed the chapter around 12 questions, and that's one of the questions. You know, did we drop the bomb primarily to intimidate the Soviet Union and to position ourselves for the post-war period? In the sense, did we use the excuse of needing to end the war in this way as a way to position ourselves to keep the Soviets in line? Now, this is a position that's actually been was articulated for the first time in the 60s with a certain forcefulness and clarity. And I think it's fair to say historians have demonstrated pretty persuasively that it was an element in the thinking of American leaders to the impact that this would have on the Soviets. Certainly impressing on the Soviets the fact that we had very powerful weapons and there was not going to be any Munich vis-a-vis communism in the post-war period. We were not going to cave in to bullying by the Red Army and by the Soviet Union. We had a weapon that meant business and we were willing to use it. This was a factor in the thinking at the highest levels in the Anglo-American, in the British and American governments. And this has been demonstrated. We have documentary evidence. We have mutually supporting diaries. This is pretty well established and accepted, by historians. Where the controversy lies is some historians have gone farther and have said this was the primary aim of Truman in dropping the bomb. And I think most historians part company do not accept that conclusion. Most historians will say this was sort of an added bonus, but the primary aim of Truman in dropping the bomb was to end the war, and by shortening the war dramatically, by ending the war quickly, saving as many lives on our side as possible. I don't think foremost in Truman's concern was saving Japanese lives, but that was one of the other in unintended effects, shall we say, of dropping the bomb, saving a larger number of Japanese lives. So the motivation regarding the Soviet Union, there's been a recent book by a Harvard historian, Tsuyoshi Hasegawa, that has, or maybe it's Harvard University Press, I'm not sure which university he's at, called Racing the Enemy. And that's another book that has really explored this whole aspect of politics and diplomacy of the dropping of the bomb. But I would say that the majority of historians do not believe that was the primary goal, was to intimidate the Soviet Union.
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon, historian Michael Bass, author of Choices Under Fire, Moral Dimensions of World War II. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions with the phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
I have 2 points, I guess. The first one is backtracking to the issue of learning from the past and the statement just a minute ago about Munich. The issue that Chamberlain dealt with was trying to solve the causes of World War I when he went to Munich.
Yeah.
And the main concern that he had was that, in his view, the cause of conflict between Britain and Germany at World War I was naval armaments. And when he got off the plane in Britain saying, "This is peace of our time," he waved a piece of paper, which was the naval agreement between Britain and Germany. And so much of what we do in trying to solve the mistakes of the past are making new mistakes for the present. He's not the only one, and that's not the only example that I would draw, I suppose. The next point I'd like to make, I guess, is in respect to the bombing issue in respect to the atomic bomb and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In the military mind, it was nothing more than the same thing as carpet bombing. And that if you can't condemn carpet bombing, then you do have to condemn the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki also.
Well, let me start with this last point that you make. I condemn the firebombing and the carpet bombing.
Yes, I know.
But I make a different judgment about the atomic bombing, because the carpet bombing and fire bombing had been going on at that scale, at this very, very high level, for at least a year and a half, probably 2 years, and had not yet come close to bringing the war to an end. The Japanese were able to withstand the flattening of 66 of their largest cities in the spring of 1945. And they were no nearer to surrender at the end of the flattening of their 66 cities than they had been at the beginning of 1945. And the atomic bomb, because it was qualitatively different, and also one should not underestimate the importance of the fact that in between the two bombings, August 6th and August 9th, on August 8th came the attack by the Soviet Union against Japanese forces in China. And that was their last hope crumbling down. That was where the emperor really, between the atomic bombs and the Soviet entry into the war against them, that was the last straw, and the emperor realized that the war was truly hopeless and that his fanatical military leaders were leading him down a path that just was going to cause needless annihilation. And I think that's what really convinced him. But the atomic bomb was a major factor in bringing the war to a speedy end. And that had definitely not been the case with the conventional bombardment, even though if you look at the effect on the ground, I completely agree with you that the two look very similar. It's very hard to distinguish.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Next, we're going to take a call from a listener in Chicago on line four. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I guess your argument for the short-term gains and loss of life are probably undeniable. However, here 50 years hence, we're trying to tell the rest of the world they have no right to an atomic bomb, but we do.
Right.
That argument doesn't go very, very far in a rational fairness sense. Why should they not have a bomb if we have them?
Right.
And there's a secondary argument. Should they not use the bomb they have, since we have also? Maybe had we not dropped the bomb, we'd be in a better position to say, no, no, nobody should ever drop it. Now, of course, that's Monday morning quarterbacking 60 years later.
Right.
But, you know, we're at this position, at this point, the United States is in absolutely no moral position whatsoever to tell anybody whether they should have a bomb or not, or use it.
No, from a moral point of view, I agree with you. The problem is, I'm pretty sure, I think I can say with a high level of confidence that even if there had not been a Manhattan Project, sometime in the 1950s, atomic bombs would have been developed anyway. So sooner or later, we would have ended up with these nuclear killing devices that sort of catapulted us into a whole new era, a new historical era of indiscriminate, swift, immediate incineration of entire societies. So the Pandora's box argument at that level, it happened during World War II. It was accelerated by the exigencies of warfare in World War II, but we would have ended up with them anyway. And I agree with everything that you said, except I think there's also another side to it. Showing the bomb at one level was showing the destructiveness of the bomb. You can make an argument that people feared this weapon and understood the gravity of this new weapon much more graphically once it was shown to the world and what it could do, and that may paradoxically have contributed to the tremendous restraint that the two superpowers and other nuclear powers showed in recourse to this weapon in the decades that followed. So one argument can be made, you know, that in fact the dropping of the bomb gave the world a warning that then allowed us to avoid a nuclear holocaust for the half century that followed.
Is the caller still there?
Yeah, no, you make a good point, but we're still in no position to stop anybody else at this point. Actually, I think people's memory of the horror that has grown so dim that the likelihood of it happening again is increasing year by year.
And I agree with that. When I talk to my students, I show them a movie about produced by Physicians for Social Responsibility, doctors talking about what would be the medical consequences of a single atomic bomb falling on San Francisco. The students come out of there just utterly depressed and horrified. And I ask them every year, did you have any idea that this is what an atomic bomb is like? And the vast majority of them always say, no, we had no idea. Nobody's ever telling us this anymore. Whereas I grew up, I'm 50 years old, and in a generation where we were constantly being told about, you know, how awful these bombs were. And I agree with you. I think these generations are a little bit jaded. And there's even more bad news on the horizon, because I think the biological weapons of the 21st century are going to be even worse than the nuclear weapons of the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century. I think we're heading into an era of weapons that are far less easily controllable, traceable. They're going to be manufacturable in much smaller installations, and they're going to be in some ways far more deadly even than the atomic weapons. The new biological weapons are going to be even worse.
Well, the reading list of books that I think most people were encouraged to read in the 50s and 60s in school, such as Brave New World 1984 and Hiroshima,
yeah,
they're pretty much been banned, pushed out of the reading list of required reading in schools by the neoconservative and the right wing.
Well, they should be made required reading for everybody, because it's part of our reality. It's not going to go away.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. 222 WILL. Our guest this afternoon, historian Michael Bass. He is the author, most recently, of Choices Under Fire, Moral Dimensions of World War II. And let me mention that the guest also has a website where you can go and talk about some of these issues online and find some other features. And that website is www.choicesunderfire.com. One of the issues we're continuing to grapple with, this, as this last caller just mentioned, then and now, nuclear proliferation. Another issue that we are grappling with still today, that was an issue that you say was central to World War II, is the issue of race. We're grappling with this individually and collectively still today. Talk with us about the role race played in World War II.
When people hear the word race associated with World War II, the first thing they think about is the Holocaust and the attempt to exterminate all the European Jews, and rightly so. That's the most prominent exemplar of racism at work in World War II. But I argue in my first chapter in the book that, in fact, racism was far more pervasive a phenomenon. And of course, I use the word racisms because there were very many different kinds of racism all over the world, and different contexts and different ideologies were behind it. But at one level, these were all really different manifestations of the same phenomenon, where you're taking somebody because of the way they look or because of some feature that you think you can distinguish about them, and just lumping them into these stereotyped categories and deciding what you're going to do with them or about them, or what your attitude is going to be about them, simply based on that category that you've put them in. And that's racism. And it's all pervasive. It's hard to find aspects of World War II that are not affected by this. In the German-Soviet war, it was the racism of the Germans against Slavs. Within the United States, the way our own GIs were treated if they were black was absolutely appalling. And most people, I'm surprised at how many people are not aware that we had segregated forces during World War II, and the second-class and third-class treatment that black Americans faced both as soldiers and not to mention in the war industries, and of course the Japanese Americans whom we interned in this country, forever a disgraceful episode in our history, where we voluntarily truncated our own constitutional governance with the approval of the Supreme Court. It was challenged, brought up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court approved it. That such is the hysteria of wartime, and that it will justify that sort of thing. And of course, the Japanese were prey to an extremely racist ideology at this time in their history, and they treated other Asians. They had a sort of hierarchical vision of Asia, with themselves at the top and the other Asian peoples going down the hierarchy, and they treated other Asians just appallingly, killing, some historians believe, millions through famine, through maltreatment, various sorts. So everywhere you go around the world, you find the world drenched in racism, all these different racist attitudes all over the place, and it's striking. It's one of those common features of the war that only becomes apparent when you're paying attention specifically and looking for it, and then you sort of see it everywhere.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Yeah, with respect to strategic bombing and bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, et cetera, what is very interesting, after the outbreak of the Second World War, but before our involvement, the Department of the Army, in contemplation that at some point we were going to get involved, ordered a major revision of its field manual for the laws of armed conflict, which was published in 1940, just before Pearl Harbor. And, of course, here I agree with you about the Japanese refusing to come to grips with anything, any of their atrocities, pretty much in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. But in any event, this was revised and updated And this was our official interpretation of the laws of war, contemplating involvement in the war. Mm-hmm. And at that time, as I'm sure you know, the so-called Air Force was really part of the Army.
Right.
It was the Army Air Corps.
Right.
So this war manual that was issued and adhered to throughout the war, and indeed it was updated in 1944, had rules on aerial bombardment that went back to the pretty much the Hague draft rules of 1923.
Mm-hmm.
So there were rules in there.
Yes.
And if you read this manual that our own armed forces were supposed to operate in accordance with, you will see that the bombings of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, and Tokyo, at a minimum, were war crimes, even in accordance with the United States government's own official interpretation of the laws of war. And worse than that, on August 6th, we bombed Hiroshima, what, killed maybe 60,000 people.
Probably more.
But I'm just giving you a minimum estimate. On August 8th, 2 days later, we signed the Nuremberg Charter that said that a Nuremberg war crime consists in part of the wanton devastation of a city, town, or district.
Yeah.
On August 9th, then, we bombed Nagasaki and kill maybe 80,000 people. Now, that's in the Nuremberg Charter.
Yeah.
We prosecuted Nazis at Nuremberg for what our own government officials did in bombing Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, and Tokyo.
Yeah.
And indeed, what is very interesting then, in the Tokyo prosecutions, the charter there on war crimes was drawn up by General MacArthur, and pretty much followed the Nuremberg Charter, except they deleted the language on making it a Tokyo war crime to engage in the wanton devastation of cities, towns, and villages, which is clearly a consciousness of guilt. And in the dissenting opinion to the Tokyo judgment, the Indian judge, Judge Powell, said quite clearly that none of the defendants in the Japanese war criminals, the top war criminals, had anything to their discredit along the lines of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and you would really have to look at Nazi practices in Europe to find anything equivalent to these two acts.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, and the French judge and the Dutch judge joined him in that dissenting opinion, I might add.
Yeah. And the Nuremberg is a topic that you take up in the book. You know?
Yes. It's very interesting what you say. When the Germans and the Japanese tried to make that argument in their own defense, saying, you know, you did these things too. This in Latin is known as the tu quoque argument, because in Latin that means you too. It means you did it too. So if you did it too, how can you judge us for having done something similar or maybe, as they were trying to argue, lesser? What happened at Nuremberg is that the tu quoque line of defense was simply ruled inadmissible. We just said, that's not an argument that you're allowed to make. We will not consider it, because we are judging you and you're not judging us. End of story. And that was one of the most severe problems with the legitimacy of the proceedings, of the trials, in the eyes of the German and Japanese people. They felt that that our ruling out that type of argument really showed that this was just victor's justice and that it was very unfair. Having said that, I then argue in my chapter that the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals were terribly important and positive, despite their flaws and failings, and there were other flaws and failings in the proceedings, but they were very, very positive in the long run, in their long-term impact, because they set forth for the first time these principles of law that apply to individuals as individuals and not as members of some nation, or as you were not trying nations, you were trying individuals. And you're saying there are principles and there are laws that apply to all humankind, regardless of the laws of any particular nation. And that was the beginning, that was the foundation of a principle that has now been enshrined in a significant institution, the International Criminal Court. It's taken 60 years, but now it's in place, and two-thirds of the world's nations have signed on to the International Criminal Court. The United States initially supported it, and under President Clinton joined that court, and then one of the first acts of George W. Bush when he became president was to withdraw the United States from the International Criminal Court. So that was a setback, but I think in the long run, the United States will probably rejoin that court, and I see that as one of the most hopeful signs, one of the most hopeful developments that come out of World War II is this wave of internationalism, of wanting to build international institutions that are effective and fair at resolving conflicts, so that we won't have to experience another World War III, because people were very clearly aware that any other world war like this would be the end. And so this is the beginning of what I consider to be it's the third positive dimension of World War II. It's the redemptive outcome, in a sense, of all that bloodshed and all that senseless violence has been the wave of internationalist institutions seeking global governance that have emerged from the war.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Historian Michael Best, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a pleasure. These were great questions.
Historian Michael Best, author of Choices Under Fire, Moral Dimensions of World War II. The book is published by Knopf, and you can find Michael Best online at www.choicesunderfire.com.
That was a program from the Afternoon Magazine archives from December 5th of last year. It's 7 minutes, almost 8 minutes, before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices are now in. With the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Taking a look at the numbers as they finish this afternoon, Tom, from the CBOT, futures in the wheat pit were down a penny and a half. That's 1.5 for the day, as they finished up in the nearby July contract at 464.25 on the high price, the low at 455.5, and the settlement price, this is actually the May wheat, at 456.25, and they were down a half for the afternoon. The numbers in the July futures, a 480 top, low at 470, a settlement price at 470.75. And July futures at the Chicago Board of Trade finished the day down 1.25 for the afternoon, or rather 3.25 for the afternoon. The numbers in the September contract, a 491 top, low at 480, settlement price at 81.75, a penny and a quarter lower. And the December futures in the wheat pit finished with a settlement price of 493.5, down 3.5. They had a top of 501.25 and a low at 492.